Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Sand Job, the podcast that reads and reviews all of Neil Gaiman and Company's comic, graphic novel, drama, narrative, fever dream, The Sandman. I'm your host, Iris J. Pronouns are she or Zare. Really happy to be back. Had a little bit of a break due to life stuff. But we're excited to be back in the studio talking about this wild-ass comic series, and especially on what I consider to be my favorite arc of the series, Season of Mists. Joining me are my two co-hosts, Nero Villagayos O'Reilly and Jesse Gender. Why don't y'all introduce yourselves?
I'm Nero. I'm glad to finally get to the parts of the comic that are good. Pronouns are he, him.
Hey, there were good things before this comic. Not all of it, but certainly parts. I am Jesse Gender, she, they, and I also have a very sexy, gravelly voice today because I've had a sore throat all week. So if you like my dulcet tones right now, it's because of that.
No, it's fine. I imagine all of our listeners are probably listening to this right as they go to bed, so we're, like, doing, like, ASMR for them. I should really bring some, like, candy wrappers to crinkle or something, or maybe, like...
Yeah, I got something here. Wait.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm feeling the tinglies.
Ooh. Yeah, no, it's
awful.
Good.
Awful.
Yeah, right. You fall asleep, fall into the Sandman's voice. That's what you're listening to right now on Sand Job.
Very sleepy. Now, I want you to breathe in and breathe out. Feel your mind emptying.
Don't tempt me. I'm so cozy today. It's Monday.
Feel the monsters underneath your bed as they wait to come after you and grab you in the night.
Yeah. I wish.
Don't threaten me with a good time.
Season of Mists, we get a... series that's all, it's kind of after last episode where it was just four collected short stories. This one is a proper, like, arc, and it features most notably the return of Kelly Jones on the art, which we're going to get into in later issues. But for our first intro issue, they're all named episodes, and this is episode zero, the prologue. This has got Mike Dringenberg, our main man, the guy who was drawing most of the Doll's House, back on pencils with Malcolm Jones on inks.
Beautiful. Did you want to go into the summary of the...
I will say the art is gorgeous.
Yeah. At a family meeting organized by Destiny on behest of the Fates, a.k.a. the Furies, a.k.a. the Three Witches, a.k.a. the Irony, Desire accuses our boy... Morph Sandman, of maybe being just a little bit harsh when he condemned his ex-girlfriend, Nada, to 10,000 years of torment in hell. Dream, pissed off by the statement that he is, can't really deny it. So he decides to head back to the underworld to break Nada out. The art in this is really beautiful.
It is gorgeous. I'm just, like, looking through it as we're talking about it. I was like, God, I love this art.
Mm-hmm. The Destiny's realm is sort of portrayed as a reference to romantic era, like, paintings, like that it's in Arcadia Ego shit. A lot of, like, columns and, like, tall, skinny trees and placid gardens and neoclassicism. It's very Eurocentric, but it's very, like, specifically taking cues from that specific time and period and look. And when the family gets together, they all, a bunch of them kind of at least sort of try to stay on theme. Dream loves it. His fit in this, fucking amazing. He's got a big old hat, he's got a big old sash, got a big old coat, looks like a somebody dressed up as Adam Ant. Really fantastic.
And I love that he just, like, comes ready for it. Like, yeah. He's just like, because you have death beforehand being like, oh, man, I just want to wear my t-shirt and jeans. Like, what do I have to go to? What do I got to do this shit? And then she, like, puts on this. Her fit is also amazing. She's like,
I know,
fine,
I love
it.
Oh, my God. But yep. It's great because, like, Destiny basically gets told by the Fates that he needs to call a family meeting and just have them hang out. No word on what the family meeting is, just to get them to hang out. And seeing them show up and how they show up and what they show up in really tells you a lot about who these siblings are and what their personalities are like. Dream definitely takes his job entirely too seriously, and nobody else takes it seriously enough.
Yeah, I do love Desire just showing up in, like, garters and...
Yeah.
Hello, slut era engage.
Mm-hmm.
That's their work outfit.
Yeah.
That's what they got going on. See that?
Also, is this the issue where we get introduced to my favorite Delirium? I love Delirium.
Yeah. Delirium for the first time. She's kind of a Cyndi Lauper meets, like...
She's supposedly based on Tori Amos.
Real? Wow. That doesn't surprise me at all.
Gaiman's a big Tori Amos fan.
I'm not shocked by that.
But...
He's a big Tornadist anus fan. What?
No. Incorrect.
No. But, sorry, yeah. I had to do it. Sorry.
Delirium is interesting because she was formerly Delight at some point, and over time changed into... I wanted to ask your opinions on this. So, like, we know now that there are... We know at least six of the seven Endless. Destiny, Desire, Despair, Dream, Death... and Delirium. That's kind of like, they're all supposed to represent, like, archetypal concepts that stretch beyond cultures, beyond boundaries, beyond anything. How do you feel about, like, the spread of stuff covered by the Endless? Because I feel like it's a little, for me, always, it always felt a little weird that we have, like, it's weird to chart, like, the seven, like, big foundational things of, like, humanity as, like, yeah, I guess everybody dies, and everybody dreams, and I guess everybody has to deal with wanting things and being sad about stuff, and Delirium just feels like kind of a... Like, it feels like we're filling another D word here. I don't know. I don't know why Delirium is here other than to provide local color. What do you feel about that?
Local color. What was she before? I forgot.
She was Delight.
Delight. I don't know. I think it's interesting, especially when we get into a later arc in the comic series, where we start to see the change from Delight to Delirium and, like, what kind of caused that in culture. And that I kind of have a problem with. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could read more, like, that feels like the more the decay of society and everyone's like that sort of like sort of Western culture bullshit stuff.
It's because you kids be on your damn phones.
Yeah, your kids are on your phones taking drugs all the time. Yeah. So, like, that it kind of has that vibe to it that I don't really like. But I don't know. I feel like I'm sure there's like I am sure there's probably things that if you drove into more discussion on it, you could probably find, like, oh, there's different ways of these concepts having been articulated in different cultures that this is now pressing into these molds that I think probably follows a lot of, like, Joseph Campbell's monomyth sort of bullshit of, like, the archetype. Well, it goes into, like, even beyond archetypes, like, Joseph Campbell, like, the archetypical things where, like, there's these things in humanity that all of us feel and we're all supposed to be guided by them, but then it all sort of fits this, like, Western culture bullshit of, like, it all tells the same story even though we're going to ignore other stories. So, yeah, I think that these kind of fit that. That being said, I do think there's some ubiquitousness of experience. I guess my problem with it is less the fact that these are the ones chosen and more that they are expressed very clearly through Western cultural signifiers, especially with, like, Destiny being like, hey, look at my, you know, Renaissance area that's supposed to be representing the beginning of time sort of thing.
Right. Yeah, it's very seen through a extremely Western and Judeo-Christian lens. And that's really a critique that you can level at this entire arc for reasons we'll get into later.
I mean, it's really a thing you could level at the entire series for the most part.
True.
There's parts where it's not, but yeah.
I know that, like, I have to double check the source on this, but supposedly Gaiman has said that a lot of this is like this because it's part of his thesis to show that stories are shaped by those who tell them, but that feels a little bit like a cop-out to me. I will say, at least it isn't more Seven Deadly Sins, which I'm so tired of at this point.
Yeah, that's like, absolutely true.
Yeah, yeah, like, it's at least different.
What I do like is when we get to, what is it called? The one that was written just more recently,
Brief Lives, if you're talking about Delirium.
No, the one that came, Overture.
Overture.
Where I like Overture is it kind of that I think evolves the, again, I don't want to spoil for Nero, but that comic run kind of evolves the concept, I think, in a way that kind of gets at what Neil Gaiman was saying. But here it within the comic series itself, because Overture was written like a decade or so after the comic run ended. I think here it is very like Western Eurocentric, but I think that comic does a little bit better to help explode that out, but that comes way later. So
I'll be interested to get to that. That's going to be really cool.
Have you not read Overture?
I haven't read Overture yet. I've actually...
Overture is great.
Since we've started this project, I've actively been avoiding it so that I can read it fresh for this show.
Oh, okay. Great. Because, Overture is great and I think provides some really good commentary on the comic run as a whole from Neil, which is what Neil Gaiman is very, I think, very good at as an artist when he does revisit projects like Good Omens 2 season 2 recently. I mean, that's what Neil Gaiman is really good at. I mean, right? Because he's good at, in his current projects, whatever medium they may be in, he's good at sort of like going back and like analyzing what he did wrong and trying to present a commentary on it or present it in a new way that at least tries to, if not always succeed, at least trying to take in some of those critiques, which I at least appreciate him doing.
I'm gonna be really interested to read that volume when we get to it.
Yeah, Overture.
It's funny because Overture is great. A lot of people, like, the backs of the recent reprints put Overture at the start of the reading order that they recommend. But I feel like...
Really?
Yeah, it's weird because that one came out way later than everything else, so I feel like it would make much more sense to read them chronologically in terms of release, because from what I've heard, Overture is as much a commentary on the whole series as it is a story in itself. So, like, we're reading it after Endless Nights. It's going to be the 12th and final book that we read for this series at the end. I will say, for Delirium, her design's cool. I love the lettering treatment that Todd Klein did for her.
These
sort of, like, drippy, rainbow gradient, uneven, unusually emphasized speech balloons are some of the most expressive we ever see him do over the course of the comic. It's really phenomenal, and it really gives her so much more personality. Like, she, more so than maybe any of the other characters, like, she comes through in the way that she talks. I think that, and there's also like a, in the dead smack middle of the issue, there's like a 6-panel like portrait like write up about each of the, they're like little like sidebar Tiger Beat profiles on each of the Endless, talking about like what they're like, what they look like, what they smell like, you know, what they're all about, just in case you're coming in here for the first time and you weren't here for the previous three issues.
Desire has cool shadows. Despair is stinky.
Despair is a stinky woman. She is queen of her own bleak born.
So, okay, tangential question. Do they ever get into the cult that they mention here for Despair? Because that sounds interesting.
No, they don't. They don't get... They treat Despair so bad. She doesn't really get anything. It sucks. It's... That's the other thing. It's like... I feel like... I don't know... Like, I get that Desire and Despair are twins of each other. But, like, I don't... Desire can be so many open-ended things, while Despair feels like just one thing. I don't know.
Mm.
But I wish they had made her a little more complex and given her more time to flesh out in the series. But she really doesn't... She doesn't get a lot. Which sucks. Especially considering later on, you find out something very interesting about her that I won't spoil right now. But, You find that out in, like, book 10, the end. And it's like, oh, okay. Well, that... That would have been cool to know. I bet that really was interesting. Oh, well. Yeah. But, real cool bit. The dinner scene is great. They don't really talk about much except for, like, just taking, like, pot shots at each other. Desire's
yeah, so cranky.
Desire's a huge bitch. I love them so much. I'm sorry. They didn't say anything wrong. I'm completely out here apologizing.
I do love... One thing I like a lot with the art in particular for this issue is there's a lot of, like, emphasis on space. Like, there's a lot of kind of detailed mid-shots and then a lot of either, like, farther away landscape or, like, big empty panels. Like, I like the comparison of the... which page would this be? I wish there were numbers in this book. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The one right after the portraits that has the octagonal table right in the middle, comparing that with 2 pages later, that's the closer imagery of the table.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's some interesting stuff they're doing with... emphasis, especially.
Yeah. I love in that one panel Destiny saying, in the meantime, please make yourselves comfortable. And it's like a barren room the size of a fucking football field with a giant table. It's like, oh, you don't actually live in here. Nobody lives in here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a great illustration of like how incredibly like uncomfy this whole family situation actually is.
Yeah. And how they are...
Oh, sorry.
No, go.
Oh, I was gonna say, they're only really kind of, like, masquerading at being human-shaped. Like, they're not actually really human. They're more amalgamations of ideas than anything. Mm-hmm. So, like, this is all kind of a farce. But yeah. They're still going through the motions for the sake of Destiny.
Right. They have to fake it because, like, they're, when Destiny's involved, it's like, well, this is, we're in story space now. We're in, like, narrative space. We are being acted upon by a tale that is being spun. So we all have to play along.
And I do love that, like, the story is kind of, like, being, like, spun by, like, the fact that they are all here. Like, there was no agenda. They're just coming here, and then the conflict sort of naturally spun out of the fact that they are just in this place. Like, there was no intention. The narrative just sort of came from their presence.
Yeah. Them just
which I really kind of like.
Together.
Yeah.
Anyways, yeah, some great, like, Wallywood's 22 panels that always work and people fucking talking to each other in this issue.
It's good stuff.
Yeah.
Also some nice texture work. Like the on the page of Dream and Death talking to each other, there's those nice kind of like splattered textures in the background. That like look really nice.
Whenever Dringenberg and Jones get together, they always produce this like really scratchy sort of textury bumpy looking artwork that's like so it's just so pleasing for me to look at. It's visual ASMR for me, and it really defines like the Vertigo look of the time in my mind. I feel
I also do really like as well the fact that everyone's faces change, like, shape throughout this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, did you already mention that? Sorry, I might have missed that. But, like throughout the entire comic, everyone's sort of, like, their visage and the shape of their face changes slightly throughout the whole thing. Like, distinctly, like, Dream's face does not look the same at the top of it as he does at the end of it.
See, which I kind of... I'm not super wild about that, is the thing.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, like, it feels like one of those over-reliance on photo reference kind of things. But, like, they are designed in such a way that it is at least... You can still tell who is who. Personally, I think it's a little jarring sometimes.
Oh, yeah, I see. I really... Oh, please.
I like it when it's a difference in design between different artists, because I like seeing different artists give their own spin on different characters. But there are examples where the character drawing within a single issue will be inconsistent, and that I'm less enamored about. We're gonna get into fucking Kelly Jones this episode.
Fair. I particularly kind of like it, to be honest. Especially in this issue where we are in this sort of like narrative space. And so everything, and I mean even like where, like, it kind of gives me this idea that they are sort of taking the forms that they're supposed to play throughout these different stories. It kind of goes back to that archetypical idea, which, again, you can get into it being problematic. But if you're going to use the concept, I kind of like it that it's just, like, here's the, you know, the hero with a thousand faces bullshit with, like, a bunch of different faces on sort of idea, which I kind of like. But, like I said, to be fair, I can also see that being taken a problematic route, so.
Yeah, This issue is interesting. It's an interesting way to start off the whole arc.
Hmm.
I love how fucking how long it takes for Dream to really like get the picture that like that shit you did back in the day, that wasn't normal. Normal people don't do that.
Yeah, it's like normal people not cool, bro. No.
Yeah, normal people don't condemn their XGFs to hell. And, like, he's even when he's talking privately with Death, his closest companion, he is absolutely still, like, being so rigid and trying to stick to formality so much. And she's just like, dude, you gotta, like, get a hold on yourself, man. Like, I know that you were in, like, a box for 100 years, but, like, it's time to start, like, thinking about shit again. You don't have the excuse of being locked away to not think about who you are and what you've done.
Yeah.
Like,
I find it interesting that Death is always the most, like, casual and human of all of them.
Mm-hmm. I think because she works with people the most. Like, straight up. She has direct contact with people the most.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Dream only sees people when they're not conscious. Desire is more, like, permanently at arm's length from anyone. Despair only sees people at their lowest, and Delirium doesn't really, like, doesn't see eye to eye with anybody, period. So,
yeah.
It's interesting. And Destiny just doesn't talk to people at all. He just reads. Fucking bookworm.
Nerd.
anyways, moving on to episode 1, issue... this is 22, originally published in 1991. We get a little intro about hell here, and then our boy Morph announces to the entire Dreaming that he is going on a little trip down to hell to get his girlfriend back. He's already sent Kane ahead of him, and Kane has run into a spot of bother with Lucifer, who says that he's got something real fun planned for when Dream visits. We also get to see a little cameo appearance by Hippolyta Hall from The Doll's House. Remember her? And the baby that Dream said he would steal someday? He's back to check on the baby he said he was going to steal someday. So that's wild.
How's your baby? Is this baby ripe yet?
his name's Daniel, by the way. Don't name him something stupid. Name him a D name. That's good.
Yeah, I want it to be a D name. We're very into the D's in my family.
So into the D's in the family. Also a little show up by Hob Gadling from Men of Good Fortune.
Oh.
In a dream, but, you know. Really kind of like a... it's interesting with this issue because it's Dream knowing that he might get fucked over again and kind of like doing what I bet he wishes he had done before he got trapped in the box the first time, going and like saying goodbyes to like the few people who he actually gives a shit about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which is nice. We also have Kelly Jones as the artist on this issue. I love his inks. Again, they're these swirling sort of wild ass deep blacks, and I love his use of screen tones and also his panel compositions are real nice. I will say that, as we were just talking about, his faces are really inconsistent throughout his run, and especially this issue. Like, the way that, like, he draws Lucifer, really, there are some hinky-looking panels in here.
Yeah.
Is it this issue or the other one that had the really funny Lucifer face?
That's the next issue.
Okay.
But this one does have him looking like a Pomeranian who just saw you drop a cocktail wiener on the floor. I'm putting it in chat.
Oh my god, yeah.
Yeah.
See, this is where I like this less. Like, to go back to my point from the other one, it's like, here is it, what I liked about the last issue, it was very clear that each new face was, like, intentionally something different, but meant to sort of, like, evoke a similar vibe for each guy. Whereas here, it's like, it's clearly, like, aiming to try to do the same face, but it's not quite reaching it, which is why it's weird. Which is why I kind of like that compared to this one.
No, yeah.
And I'd be fine if Kelly Jones's idea of Lucifer looked different than how he looked in Preludes and Nocturnes, because, like, as we discussed, how he looked in Preludes and Nocturnes was a source of some consternation. He had to be edited out at the last minute because I guess he looked too much like David Bowie for the editing department's liking.
So, oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
So, poor Bowie devil. Yeah. We were robbed.
So it's fine that he looks different. I just wish that they would kind of keep with a consistent look throughout this book. We do see the first appearance of one of my favorite big characters in Sandman, Mazikeen the Demon, who's like kind of like Lucifer's like right hand sort of person operative. She's a demon lady who's missing the left half of her entire like face, and you can see like her half rotted skull and like teeth and shit hanging out of the side, and she talks like she can't use her lips, and they write it like that. She is so cool.
Good for her.
Yeah, just so casually disgusting looking. I fucking love every time she shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting too, because like to let Lucifer know that he's coming, Dream sends Cain of the Dreaming over to talk to him, because Cain, out of everybody in the Dreaming, Cain is the only one who he can't actually touch, because when they mention that Cain is of Cain and Abel, like, this is really kind of like setting in concrete, like, yeah, we're going via the Judeo-Christian mythos. This is the Cain, and specifically in the Bible, God made it so that, like, Cain can't be hurt by anything, so that he would live out his entire existence thinking about what he did.
Well, not can't be hurt, but can't die.
Yeah.
Yeah, he can't, because the devil does hurt him.
And therefore the Lord said unto him, therefore, whosoever slayeth Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord set a mark upon Cain, lest any finding him should kill him. So he can't, nobody's allowed to kill him. It's not like with Abel where he regenerates. It's that he, do not hurt on pain of divine retribution. Yeah. Which is interesting.
One sec. There's a different biblical translation I was looking at. One sec.
Oh, man. We're getting into theology here.
We're fighting. The girls are fighting.
But while you're looking at that, like, again, it's one of those, this is one of those difficult things where it's like, again, the comic is very Judeo-Christian, Western culture focused, but I don't mind it here because Lucifer himself is also that in the depiction, so it kind of works within the confines of that theology, which is interesting, which will also get kind of explored in just a little bit because we're going to go outside of some Western, well, the sort of typical Western cultures that people normally sort of think about with like Judeo-Christian stuff. So it's interesting to see how that'll bump up.
Mm-hmm. This fucking thing I'm looking at doesn't actually link. Well, this is the... Someone named Justin said it was wrong. I don't trust Justin anymore.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Justin.
Fucking Justin.
So I'm inclined to believe Iris is actually correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is one of those check the text kind of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Not a hell of a lot happens in this issue. Lucifer does make a lot of like
not a lot to talk about.
Yeah, he makes a big old honking deal about when Morpheus comes, you will all remember this day in hell forever. It will be so fucking epic and based. But he's doing a lie by omission because he doesn't actually say what's going to happen. He's just going to like, he's just saying, yeah, mark the date tomorrow, pointing at the WrestleMania sign right now. It's going to be big news. We see a lot of good ass little guys in this issue too. We're getting an uptick on the little guy quota for this book. And I do have to applaud Jones for that. He's drawing his little guys so weird. There's like a lady at the start of the issue with like with teeth in her nipples, yeah. And I know plenty of people who'd be actually into that, but it's really we really get like an entrails vibe to his vision of hell here. It's a very like very guts based goopy sort of look, which is really fun.
Guts core.
Very guts core. Anyways, moving on to the next issue, number 23, episode 2. What's my summary? Yeah. Dream finally arrives at Hell to break Nada out, only to find that Hell is completely empty, and Nada is nowhere to be found. Lucifer is quitting his job at Hell's Overseer. He's absolutely sick of the gig, he's sick of the people he has to work with, and he's sick of the people he has to torture every day. Dream travels with him as he locks up the final doors to Hell and tells the last remaining stragglers to get the fuck out. And as a final little fuck you to Dream for that business in Preludes and Nocturnes, he gives the key to all of Hell, and as well as ownership of the realm itself to him before he leaves, as just a little curse. He says, the line I believe he says is specifically, scrolling to it, Chester, fuck off of my desk. He doesn't say that. Yeah. It's all yours now, Morpheus. You're the sole monarch of a lost, locked and empty hell. Perhaps I ought to have given it to you with my best wishes. I could have told you that I hoped it would bring you happiness. But somehow I doubt it will. Very, very ominous.
Mm-hmm.
We get so much, like, Paradise Lost-ass vibe in this. The Lucifer that Gaben is pulling from for this is very John Milton-y in that
he's constantly referencing Milton.
Yeah, yeah. He's the angel Samael who didn't so much rebel as got, like, kicked on his ass out of heaven by God, and now he's got to live in the dump, and everything sucks forever. And he's never done a single bad thing in his life, et cetera, et cetera. I do think it's, like, what did y'all think about this concept of hell? The idea that sinners are really only there because they want to be. How did y'all feel about that?
It's very Catholic.
Yeah, it is very, very Catholic.
Like, you're only there because you're like, well, I should be punished, so I guess I'm here. Which, I mean, I feel like it's a it's an interesting way to sidestep the general, like, problems that come with media about, like, hell and depictions of hell, where it's like, how do you decide who goes to hell, who is qualified, who isn't? Making it a personal punishment, I think, is a more interesting spin. I will say that does make Nada's whole thing weirder.
Yeah, because she didn't choose to be there. She was just stuck there by dream.
Yeah, so it's like, well, she doesn't want to be there, so why is she still there? Like, does this mean that, like, if we're speaking in, like, Dragon Ball Z power levels, like, is Dream higher up than Lucifer? Like, I guess maybe he is, because Lucifer is also giving him the key as a fuck you anyway, so.
Yeah, from what it seemed like, Dream has stated that Lucifer is more powerful than him.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, the fact that Nada was still there is, I don't know. Maybe this is one of those things where this idea of making hell somewhere people condemn themselves, one of those things where, like, it was inserted halfway through the script and then forgotten about the implications of, you know?
Oh, I could believe that. Like, or vice versa, where the bit about Nada getting sent to hell was way earlier, before Neil had really fleshed out the concept of how hell's mechanics actually work.
Yeah, yeah.
They really,
I can definitely see that.
Yeah, it's. Sorry, please.
No. I was just gonna say too. Hell gets interesting when you think about it with, like, how it's often used, because it is sort of like this, like, almighty judgment, which is very rooted in, like, again, Judeo-Christian, like, norms and stuff. And so, yeah, making it, like, individually, like, you wanted to be here does sort of, like, sidestep that, like, oh, we have to have some sort of, like universal law of good and evil. Which gets into that, like, really fucking, again, which values do we center, and, you know, that becomes all, like, are gay people sent to hell, like, that sort of stuff. And I think they always think, like, the best way to, like, discuss hell is, like, a version of a system, like, being self-aware of hell as, like, a version of, like, how a system values people or not. So, like, Judeo-Christian folks would just be like, gay people go to hell because that's what God wants. But it's like, if you analyze that as, like, a self-analysis of, like, why, like, queer people reclaiming that, it's like, yeah, we go to hell, we party down there, like that sort of reclaiming an awareness of how the system otherizes people. I think another good example of how hell was used was in, like, The Good Place, where hell is used as, like, very clearly, like, a metaphor for, like, understanding that capitalism causes us all to be complicit in horrific things, and sort of, like, discussing the product of that. So if you use hell as, like, an equator of a system's value of people, I think it's interesting. Here it kind of says that for individualism, which I think is a bit of a cop-out, but
right. Yeah, it's, this kind of thing is always interesting to discuss, because, like, hell as it stands, as in terms of we speak of this particular conception of hell, is kind of, it inherently is, like, an irrational number by default. It's like, it's like pi. It's like, it, in the way it exists in Christian dogma, it doesn't really jar with anything else, but it has to make it has to exist for so many other things that the church kind of greases its wheels on to exist. The existence of hell is kind of an irrational number that needs to be resolved when thinking about theology in any sort of, like, literary or thematic capacity, because it inherently doesn't make sense and doesn't seem like it even should in sort of a universe with a loving God. I think that the sort of exchange with Breschau of Livonia really kind of highlights this the kind of issue with the concept of hell in general. Like, here's this dude who was a fucking nightmare, like, absolutely one of, like, the most ghoulish dudes in history, and he's been punishing himself for thousands and thousands of years for it. He's got himself chained to a rock. All of his skin is, like, peeled off. Things seem like it sucks for him. But when Lucifer and Dream show up and Lucifer tells him he can, like, finally leave because he's shutting hell down, he's shocked that he feels like he hasn't even remotely begun to be punished enough. The problem is literally anything humans can do in their lives, no matter how heinous, is nothing more than like an atom in the face of the expanse of infinity. People have forgotten who Brashaw is. People have forgotten where Livonia is. People have forgotten about the things that Brashaw has done. And when you forget about somebody and the things that they do, do they really still need to be punished for it? It's like the opposite of, like, if you're saying somebody's name, they're not really dead. It's like if nobody's saying somebody's name, like, if their crimes have evaporated from relevance, then what's the point of them still being raked over the coals for that, you know? Hell inherently cannot exist as a place of restorative justice in this setup that Lucifer rules over.
Can I get to, like, philosophy of stories and stuff? It's like the story of a lot of, like, Judeo-Christian bullshit that, like, builds itself up upon colonialism, which builds itself up upon, you know, white supremacy, which builds itself up upon, you know, patriarchy, etc., which is like, people can't change. It's very cynical, like, we all can't change. Nothing matters. Nothing can ever restore yourself. You can't get better. You can't change. Which is actually kind of why I never read it, but I like the concept of, like, Lucifer, is like the comic series that sort of spun out of this idea here. Of, like, him being like, all right, I'm going to just go and try to be a dude, you know, now. And so I never read the comic, so I can't tell you if it's good or not.
I've read all of it, actually. It's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, so I like that. It is kind of pushes back against that idea of, like, there's no restorative justice and everything. Sin is an intrinsic part of humanity, and we are all just intrinsically, like, awful beings.
Yeah, you know. The interesting thing about it is that, especially if you bring up Lucifer, Lucifer ties into Sandman, but it also ties a lot into John Constantine Hellblazer a lot. And it's wild because while the concept of the damned being just, like, there voluntarily is something that's set up here in the Sandman, there are still infernal powers. There are still demons and stuff who reside in hell and who got to hell from other places, either as fallen angels or as creatures from other planes or existences entirely. And those are still painted as purely irrational beings who are capable of intelligent thought and capable of reasoning, but just have the goal of being these, like, these malignant forces. They exist to hurt, to cause pain, and to hurt themselves. To be corruptive influences. So, like, it's interesting that, like, Lucifer doesn't want to do that. Lucifer doesn't want to be that person. But there's this sort of, it's like hell's middle class. The people who aren't at the bottom, but aren't at the top either. And they somehow got in their heads that, like, the thing that they wanted to do from the beginning was find somebody to take out their grievances on. And, like, they essentially built this whole structure around them, including putting the guy at the top into this framework of, clearly we are here to just exact punishment. Clearly we are here to raise Cain on the surface world. Clearly we're here to make the rest of existence just as bad as where we are now. Like, they're trying to spread that level of irrationality out across the rest of creation. I just think it's interesting that, like, that's like, it's like, why, you know, there's such a, my friend Sophie was talking about this on Twitter earlier, where it's like, there's such a trend nowadays of We have to make the monsters in our stories feel human and empathetic so that we can understand them better and so that they're less problematic and so that they get their stories told. And yeah, absolutely. But also, like, what do you do when the characters in question are, like, you know, ribbon my petal and whatnot in here, where they are inherently irrational and inherently thirsting for just decay? When we get into talking about the demon demon contingent later on, led by Azazel, we're going to be talking more about that.
I think it's interesting because we can move on from this and focus on the comic again. Yeah. But like, I find that to be like a super fascinating idea because I think what ultimately a lot of like the stories that let's humanize the villain try to do is try to. It's interesting who we human. I guess the better way to put it is, like, if you look at a lot of stories, it's interesting who we humanize and who we paint as irrational. So what mm-hmm. I find in a lot of the stories today is we humanize those in power. Like, we'll, like, see CEO-type characters get humanized as, like, oh, they're just, you know, they're trying their best, da-da-da-da-da-da. Like, I saw For All Mankind is a show I really like, and it has, like, an Elon Musk-esque character who is less of a douche nozzle than Elon Musk, but it sort of, like, paints him as a flawed human. But then you get to, like a lot of Marvel movies, and especially the Marvel TV shows, you look at, like, Secret Invasion or Falcon and the Winter Soldier or a couple others, where it'll be, like, the people who act irrationally are, like, the marginalized people asking to not be oppressed. It's like people in power get the benefit of, like, you act rationally, but you do bad things so we can understand you. Whereas, like, the marginalized people fighting back to get oppressed is like, we're just going to murder just because, and there's no real logic to it, even if their, like, viewpoints are inherently sympathetic. And so they're mm-hmm. framed as irrational. And it kind of fits into that sort of, like, Western culture framing that sort of ultimately upholds those systems of white supremacy. And so I think it's interesting to me to be like, flip that on its head and be like, yeah, the people in power who aren't willing to change the system, they can go fuck themselves. Even if we understand where they come from and the human motivations, because that's what I'm writing my own thing right now that Iris, you're involved in, that like is like about that. Like, that's going to be my end point with it is that.
Yeah.
So,
but also at the end of the day, Lucifer is kind of the CEO of hell, and he feels real bad about it. And the demons are kind of refugees, and they just want their land back, and they're very irrational about it. So, but I don't know.
I mean, it's a very Western culture perspective. I mean, it goes to, like, if we're staying in Sandman, we talked about, like, the Night of a Thousand Cats issue. Of, like, the same problem in that comic is, like, oh, but the cats just want to do the same thing to the humans, and it's just a perpetual cycle of the oppressed want to become the oppressors. And I'm like, no, if you actually look at people who are often oppressed, you will actually find that most of them just want to create an egalitarian society. Yes, some of them are like, fuck, let's kill everybody, but most people are just like, no, I'll kill the people and fight the people who are currently oppressing me, but I don't want to become them, you know? But it's just this story that people in power tell. So, like, the reason I bring it up is, like, even though I think Neil Gaiman is very sympathetic and very understanding, especially to, like, marginalized folks as he is to, like, trans people and queer people without the comics, he still puts them in that framing of, like, either pitiable beings or, like, they're just as cynical as we are sort of idea. I've been thinking a lot about this lately, so sorry.
Oh, yeah, no worries. Interesting issue. Sorry?
I do think that I think it's interesting also that Lucifer's, like, kind of last action is his own, like, final self-punishment of having Dream cut off his wings.
Yeah.
For no other reason than just a symbolic measure. I suppose. I don't know. I think it's also that he just didn't bother to quit earlier, like that this was a reaction, like an excuse to be like, you know what?
Yeah.
If Dream wants to come down here, then I guess I'm done, which is it's a little petulant, you know? Like, if you actually gave a shit, you should have quit earlier.
Yeah, but maybe he felt bound by his station, by his job or whatever.
Oh no, I just had to push the button.
Man, being a leader is so hard. Anyways, I will say, Listeners, I'm kind of a freak here, but yo, that scene where Dream is like cutting off his wings, that shit was hot.
Romance is alive.
That's some gay shit right there. That's cool. And that's on like a 2-page spread where the facing page is Lucifer making out with Mazikeen before he sends her away. You can see his tongue sticking through the side of her face. It whips so hard. And her brains are dripping out. Oh my god. So good.
I love the art.
Vertigo
the,
Comics like, gross rock.
You could make a really interesting read in regards to like when sexuality shows up in the Sandman comic as being like either kind of homoerotic or in kind of a shocking sense. Like, it doesn't seem to often show up in like other contexts.
Yeah, there's, you know, it's interesting that we get the juxtaposition of gross thing with woman is a kiss, gross thing with man is cutting off a body part.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's something. There's
some gender ideology going on there, huh, Neil? How's it going?
Which is also interesting, too, when you put into context of how women are often objectified. Like, men's biggest fear when they write is becoming, like, seeing part of their body become object.
Yeah.
Where women become, like, body parts become object all the time. Like, when, like, look at, like, framing in film. Women will be, like, you just see, like, their foot or their breast, and it's, like, cut off from, like, viewing them as whole beings.
Or even just in Sandman period, how women have been treated so far.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna say,
women becoming objects, and women and queer people becoming objects for, like, serial killers and shit.
Yeah,
I legit feel like you could make a strong case, and maybe that is the case we're making over the course of this podcast, that the Sandman is about stories, but what it's really about is female agency.
Yeah.
One last thing before we move on from this issue. You know, I bag on Kelly Jones sometimes, but the panel that shows the main gates of hell, that's sick as fuck. That 2-page spread goes so goddamn hard. It rules. Mm-hmm. It's some like H.R. Geiger shit. It is so cool. And all the similarly like knobbly little H.R. Geiger shit that he puts into the margins of the of the panels and stuff. Very rad. Love that.
I mean, it very much looks like I see a bunch of dicks in Hell's architecture. It's great.
Yeah, it's very carrying on Sam Keith and his work on the series. This is the Keithiest that Jones really gets, which is fun. You can see the logic behind hiring him on for this story.
Yeah.
I do like also it's like the way it's drawn, it's very clear that Hell is a very desolate place, but they didn't cop out by just making the background like, you know, a line. Like there's still even if it's desolate and empty, there's still physical features there. Like there's, you know, the edge of the water, there's like the remnants of like burning cities, like there's still things technically there. Like, it isn't a total absence.
It's cool.
Neat comic.
Neat comic. Next issue.
Wow.
Number 24, issue number 3. Word gets around about Lucifer quitting and Dream getting the key to hell. Pretty soon, a whole mess of deities, demiurges, and anthropomorphic concepts crawl out of the woodwork to bug Dream for ownership of this hot new place of psychic real estate. This is where we kind of see the players for what the arc is setting up. We get to see that like the world of Sandman doesn't just have like Judeo-Christian stuff in it. It has other sort of archaic religions too. And whether these exist as sort of realms of story or realms of parallel belief systems or whatever is kind of left open to debate. Specifically, the ones we get to focus on are Odin, Thor, and Loki from the Norse pantheon. We see in this issue Kilderkin of, or no, we don't see Kilderkin show up, but we see the kingdoms of order and chaos, and we see the angels Remiel and Duma from the Silver City. And the demon contingent led by Azazel, formerly a member of the Triumvirate of Hell, now a triumvirate of jack shit nothing, but a whole bunch of angry demons. Mm-hmm. This is a wild-ass issue of just because it starts with, like, showing Loki tied up beneath the earth with a snake dripping poison into his face. And, like, I want to, like, when I read this, I was like, you know what? Like, this really didn't occur to me when I was a teenager, but, like, nowadays, what with, like, fucking superhero media saturation, if it's, like, the, like, 91 and you're a huge comic book nerd and you're, like, picking up this issue in your local shop, you probably have a pretty set idea of what a comic book version of Odin, Loki, and Thor all look like. So to, like, see this must have been fucked up.
It's great. This is honestly one of my favorite versions in terms of, like, look of Loki in, like, anything. Mm-hmm. I really, really like this. It is interesting that, like, given the context of what we're talking about, that the story picks up here with Loki. Is, mm-hmm. like, this is the place that he's currently in the story of Sandman, because this is an actual, like, story from Norse mythology that mm-hmm. Loki ends up, you know, after having killed Baldur, or leading someone to be tricked into killing Baldur, he gets punished and put under here and tortured for a really long time. Mm-hmm. But eventually he does break free and cause Ragnarok, which I think gets mentioned a few times throughout here, and helps lead the Battle of Ragnarok. So, like, you could have put Loki at any point in his timeline, but to put it here specifically is kind of going to that idea of, like, eternal punishment, damnation, yeah. that tying into the Lucifer sort of mm-hmm. stuff going on.
I did like the detail of one of the close-up panels. Loki has all of the scars around his lips from having I forget if it's this myth specifically, but there's one where he's got, like, as part of his punishment, they sew his mouth shut with leather cords.
Jesus Christ.
I thought that was a great little detail in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's gross. It's, it's a bad analogy to use, but I think of it as, like, the Kingdom Hearts problem, where if there's a bunch of, like, mythology realms sitting around, then when you go there, they're in the middle of their whole business. But that shit is always happening, and it's happening at, like, a time scale that's different from others. So, like, mm-hmm. we're coming in here, and, like, Jack Skellington hasn't figured out what Christmas is yet, so to speak. Mm-hmm. but yeah.
It's a good analogy.
Thank you. I try. I also love that, like, Thor's a huge jackass with a teeny tiny little hammer. Like, this is designed to piss Marvel fans off. That's just great.
It is, but, like, this is actually, like, very Norse mythos accurate. Like, I was also about to mention, like, Odin being depicted as, like, a guy who wears a cloak and travels a lot and is not, mm-hmm. like, this beefy king dude. Like, that's actually how... Because, like, Odin, like, traveled a whole bunch and, like, would travel the realms and, you know, do a bunch of sexual assault. But yeah, no, like, that's how he actually is. Like, and the idea of Thor being, like, this dumb, beefy idiot, like, again, also very accurate. So, like, yeah, And, like, the hammer that he has was also, like, made by the dwarves in the comic, so of course it would be kind of small. So, like, yeah, it's meant to piss comic fans off, but also it's, like, very mythology accurate.
Yeah, yeah. I do also like the very brief, and I'm pulling this from a note that was apparently, like, one of Gaiman's annotated scripts, but the space that we see right after this with the big mirror where Dream contacts order.
Yeah. Plans.
That's apparently supposed to be, like, his private quarters.
Really?
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
It's very pretty.
Yeah. Like, I wish we saw a little more of that in general, but
yeah.
This isn't Dream's bedroom tour.
It is very, like, early 90s, like Soho chic, like, just, like, a lot of, like, neoclassical elements sprinkled around a real, like, minimalist sort of setting. I dig it. I also like that he talks to his griffin outside through a statue of the griffin in the room. That's some fun shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Honestly, my favorite stylistic touch of the whole issue is the single page, one page, with Order and Chaos, and about how Not only does their dialogue basically mirror each other, but also the panels for Chaos are just created by photocopying the panels drawn for Order and smearing them around as the head of the photocopier passed over them.
Oh, that's so cool, sick.
That's such a flex. I love that shit.
I love that so much, actually.
They're basically kind of the same realm. They don't make sense without the other. So it would make sense that they're basically playing the same sort of aesthetic space.
Dichotomy.
Yeah.
You have no much how much. I love that. Oh my god. It's very cool.
We get a little peek at what Death is up to. She's having a hard time because the dead from hell are coming back to Earth. We're going to see more of that in the next issue, which is fun.
I feel bad for her.
she's got a hard job ahead of her. Actually, fun fact, later on, Jill Thompson, frequent collaborator of Neil Gaiman, actually did a manga style, quote unquote, graphic novel short story thing about Death trying to sort out this specific period in the story where she was running around trying to get people to like go back to the afterlife instead of coming to Earth, called At Death's Door. You can look it up. One sec.
Oh, this is a style.
It is so like original English manga.
2003, that explains it.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I kind of love it, and I kind of want a copy of it, but it is very like, this is this is something that could only happen at this specific point in time. And this isn't related to Death, the time of your life. This is like a different thing. There are so many weird spin-offs with Sandman. It's bizarre. Next episode, I'm going to talk about how many times they tried to reboot Dead Boy Detectives as a result of the one issue 4. 5 times. Fucked up. We get a peek at the Silver City, which is where angels live. It's not heaven. It's a Silver City. Supposedly, it's different.
I loved how this looked.
Yeah.
This is great.
Real, like, Kelly wants us to know that he can draw the shit out of some fabric folds.
Good for him.
And I also got to say, like, I really love the glow-up he gave Azazel. In Preludes and Nocturnes, he's just kind of a big hovering wad of eyeballs. And this Azazel looks like a tear in reality through which there's a bunch of glittering stars and eyes and angry razor-sharp teeth. And that's like, this is the most 90s character design. You boiled it down to just the cool, scary teeth, and that's it. It's so good.
Which I love, and I can't get it out of my brain now, because there was a – make sure I say this the right way. There was a YouTuber who I like who hated this design where it appeared in other mediums and absolutely despised this design. And I was like, no, this is great. I fucking love this thing with its weird, teethy, like, nebula nonsense.
Yeah, it makes so much sense that the guy in charge of trying to get Hell to become a place again is a dude who is kind of a place in and of himself, or at least some sort of dimensional thing. And we found out that they're the ones who've got Nada. They're holding Nada hostage this entire time. Demons are a piece of shit. Imagine. We also see a return of our boy Chronazon, the guy from Preludes, who's just so, I think he's just so hyped for screen time here. I just love to see him. He's one of those guys I love to see with his freaky two mouths.
Oh, double mouth boy.
Yeah.
Yep. I love double mouth boy.
Spectacular ink work in this too. Like some like really nice like flexible nib, like very varied line weights, like especially you can see it a lot in like the wings for the angels, but those like the parallel lines, like that's a lot of work.
Yeah,
so good,
real fiddly. We also get for factions, there's two factions who don't really get as much screen time. Susano no Mikoto from the Japanese pantheon, and Anubis, Bast, and Bes from the Egyptian pantheon.
Oh, yeah, everyone shows up at Dream's house.
Everybody shows up at his house, and they're like, yo, can we have the key, please? And, like, he just throws a dinner party to get them to basically stop bothering him and talk to him one at a time. Which, you know, probably what I would do, I guess. It is kind of rude to turn up uninvited, but it's... I'm not going to mention that... So... This is one of those fucking things, and I know I shouldn't say shit like this because I'm a furry, so I really should show up and, stump for the side. But in Egyptian mythology, they didn't actually have animal heads. When they were drawn in the art, what that meant was they could turn into forms of those animals fully. That they were those things at the same time. That didn't necessarily mean that they were anthropomorphic animal people. So these are more like pop culture ideas of the Egyptian gods. That being said, I love me a fucking pointy ass boy out here. He's just a weird little triangle man with big ass arms and a weird face, and I love looking at him so much.
And I love Bes, who's just like a short guy.
This is our short king who we brought with us to oversee the proceedings.
Like, I think isn't Bes usually like a crocodile? No.
No, you're thinking of Ahmet the Devourer, I think. Thinking of Offler the crocodile-headed god from Discworld, because that's not a real deity. That is from books. That is from my other podcasts.
Oh, yeah. Bes, together with his feminine counterpart Beset, is an ancient deity worshipped as protector of households, in particular of mothers, children, and childbirth. It's an interesting one to bring along with you.
Maybe as the slightly more human contingent. And I guess it would be more exciting than, like, Osiris, who's, like, a fucking dead guy who's missing his dick. And or Sekhmet, a lion woman who will kill anyone at any time for fun. Or Set, who is some kind of animal that historians still have yet to agree upon what he was, and was a complete piece of shit, even by God's standards.
Oh, I will say one thing that did piss me off a little. The fucking addition of the like fucking chopsticks font shit on Susano. Like,
we've been talking a lot about how good Todd Klein is for a lot of these speech balloons. That was not one of his triumphs.
I saw that and I think out loud just said, "Oh fucking come on."
It's
like, man.
It's weird too because like I think they do a couple interesting things with Susano later that were kind of neat. But there's so much myth. I don't think it's necessarily like, wow, racist. I think it's more just like there's so much missed potential there. Like, Japan has such a historically broad language of comics out there that there's so many and like a lot of visual references with their pantheon, that there's so many different ways you could take that. There's so much potential there you could have for stylistic touches. And I think just showing him as like a dude where it's like, ah, yes, this dude doesn't talk directly at anyone, which, you know, that is kind of a thing with Japanese language, sort of, is like, it's a little less direct. And also we're going to give him the Chinese takeout box font. It just seems like a little like, I don't know. I wish they had given every deity we were going to talk about a little more room here on the page. But
yeah,
you only got 22 pages per month, so I get it.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting that they used him instead of Amaterasu, who is his older sister.
Yeah, but
you know, like from the video game,
there is the joke later that wouldn't work. Then, if they did that.
Yeah, true.
And this is before the video game. It's this, I will say, this whole scene really makes me want to read The Wicked and the Divine again. There's a comic series that fucking bangs.
It seriously is good. I do love Chronazon's fucking shitty fitted suit.
Yeah! That they show him in. My man always shows up to the party dressed to the nines. So good.
Oh, I love it.
And then also, okay, so I couldn't find anything about it when I was doing a brief look, but is Lord Kildarkern like a reference to something?
I don't think so. I think he was made up for this.
Yeah. And if so, why?
Yeah, there's choices made with that.
Like, were they trying to kind of get, like, Buddhism in there and then realized halfway through, like, oh no, wait, that doesn't work? And then just, like, redrew things at the last minute, or what?
Yeah, I don't know what it's weird, because it's like he's a slave of him, so it's like Buddhism, but Buddhism's a slave of order. Yeah. That's weird.
It's very, like... We have Orientalist guy here holding the real guy who is a cardboard box. Fuck it.
I mean, I love the idea of like order being a cardboard box. Oh, yeah. I like that. That's a great idea.
That is.
But
you know what I think would have worked better? If it had just been like a UPS guy.
Yeah. That would have been really good.
It would have been a special order.
Yeah.
I'm so funny, Neil. I'm coming for your fucking job. Watch your back.
Yeah, that would have actually been very funny. Yeah. The idea that order is a cardboard box is great. The Orientalism less.
Not so much.
I guess they were like we have two varieties of Asia.
Yeah. Finally, speaking of varieties of Asia, I will say Dream's kind of ersatz Persian fit in the last bit. Pretty cool. Won't lie. Mm-hmm. I really like that, like, long, drapey thing. I love him with, like, the longer hair, too. It's a good look. I'm always out here judging Dream's various fits.
The fucking, the flecked ink look they do for his hair, that's some inspired stuff to show that it's, like, wispy. Like, it's very good.
Mm-hmm. Good inking. This is like Kelly figured some shit out for this issue.
Yeah.
That's not Kelly's job. That's Malcolm Jones III, who has been the inker this whole time. Okay. Well, great work, Malcolm. Or no, wait. No, it's not. It's no, Pete Craig
it's
Russell.
Pete Craig
oh
Russell.
My God. I forgot Pete Craig Russell was on this. Yo. Oh, no wonder the inking is so fucking good. Holy shit. Pete Craig Russell rules. He does other issues of Sandman later on down the line. We're going to be talking about him when he gets his Fables and Reflections. And he's done a bunch of other comic work with Neil later on. He did that one that was, I think it's literally just called like Murder Mystery or something. It's about like an angel getting murdered in heaven. He's done other adaptations of Neil's short story work that's been really good. Fantastic artist in his own right has done adaptations of The Magic Flute and I think The Ring Cycle. And he's also totally gay, so what's up?
Oh, no, I remember this now because he does doesn't he do the really racist Sandman, unfortunately, Ramadan?
Yes. Yes.
I remember you saying, like, it's got one of the best artists on it for one of the worst stories.
Yes. Yeah. Bad sad. Story. But man, the art in it is so good. That's the problem. This series is a land of many contrasts, I swear. Art in it, like, fucks. It's so good. But, yeah. Yeah, no. That was the first half of Season of Mists. When we come back next time, we're going to be covering issues 5 to 8, or should I say episodes 4 to infinity. Where we find out what every faction has to offer and what Morph ultimately decides to do with the heaviest key in the multiverse. Until next time, thanks for listening. We've been Sandjob. You can find us online, sandjob.xyz. We have a Twitter, Sandjob, on there. We have a co-host, Sandjob. Or no, it's Sandjob Pod on Twitter, Sandjob Pod on co-host, Sandjob Pod on mass.to. You can find all our updates there. Since the last episode, some things happened to social media, and it's been a lot harder to get in touch with or find anybody now. So get that RSS reader and punch us in there. We'll be putting out new episodes when we can. This is prestige format, so we'll put them out when we fucking feel like it. I'm Iris J. You can find me online at irisj.net or Iris J Comics and social media. The thing I'm going to recommend this week is a television show called Undead Murder Farce. Really fun stuff. If you dig Sandman type stuff, you may very well dig this. It is based on a series of Japanese novels about a person who is a half oni and a person who is an immortal who is a deathless sort of Japanese mythology being who has had her head cut off from the rest of her body. So she's just a head inside of a bird cage. And together, they, along with the immortal woman's maid, they travel to Europe to solve supernatural-related crimes and to track down who cut off the immortal's head and who turned the other guy into a half-oni. It's very, like, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen slash Penny Dreadful, like, schlocky public domain crossover adventure style bullshit, but I think it's very charming. I love that they have they stuck Arsene Lupin in there, but not Lupin the Third, the original Arsene Lupin, and they make him look as different from that Lupin as possible so that you don't get the two confused. And he has, like, he gets Eric from Phantom of the Opera, the Phantom of the Opera, as his, like, sidekick. And they're, like, a hot boy, maybe antagonist, maybe protagonist, sort of, like, duo with the series. It's really fun. It's like, if you're into this kind of, like, historical fiction, like, kind of pulp shit, which I am, it's a weakness of mine. It's a very stylish and cool show written from a perspective you don't normally see it from because it's about European literature, but it's through a Japanese literary lens. Very cool. Been enjoying that a lot this season.
Hell yeah. I'm Nero. You can find me at itsnero.com. My recommendation for this week is the mashups by the YouTuber One Board Jew. She's been around since, like, 2010 and is still making stuff, and it's still surprisingly very good. She did a bunch of Jason Derulo stuff that's pretty good.
Huh. Yeah, her shit rules.
Yeah. let's see.
So my music tastes are all over the damn place.
Love it.
But that's why mashups are great. You can listen to all the music at the same time for efficiency's sake.
Just play every song at the same exact time. Every song ever made, just hit play. And then just, that's the music.
The perfect
you did
song.
Music. Yeah, exactly. Beautiful chaos. You can find me at Jesse Gender on YouTube, is the main place where I do videos type of stuff. Depending on when this comes out, my most recent video will either be, a video on, kind of talking about how found families, are found in, like, different, in the Guardians of the Galaxy types of stories. And I think that's really fun, so check that video out. And then for my recommendation, I want to say I found this new band. I don't know much about them, but I've been listening to their songs a shit ton. Called why am I blanking on it? Called The Midnight, and they're very, very good. They're very, like, synth wavy, but I love their lyrics a lot. Ooh. It's really fantastic. I would highly recommend them.
Check them out. That's great. Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening, folks. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, sweet dreams. Ooh.